Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Medical Ethics Unpacked. I'm Steve Levine, and I'm joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dr. Dominic Sisti. Today, we'll be diving into a discussion on vaccines. For many, the science and public health benefit of vaccination are long-settled issues. However, a time of growing medical skepticism and politicization of science has yielded new controversy and debate. To help us unpack this thorny subject, we're honored to welcome today's guest, Dr. Jason Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz is an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Yale School of Public Health. His research examines vaccines and vaccination policy, decision-making in medical regulation and public health policy, and the structure and function of scientific expert advice to government. The overall focus of his work is on the ways in which evidence is interpreted, evaluated, and translated into regulation and policy in medicine and public health. He holds a secondary appointment in the section of the history of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine, so he's well suited to frame this conversation within a longitudinal perspective. Welcome, Dr. Schwartz.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks, Steve, for that intro. And Jason, it's great to see you again. And I'm looking forward to our conversation. Just wanted to just start us off, given recent news and where we are with, say, COVID vaccine recommendations and measles vaccine recommendations and what we're hearing out of HHS and out of Secretary Kennedy's mouth. Where are we now and how did we get here?
Oh, the million-dollar question. It has been one of the most turbulent periods in vaccination policy here in the U.S. In recent history, to be sure. The new administration has unveiled pretty dramatic shifts, not just in policies, but in messaging and framing and how we've heard and talked and communicated the importance of vaccines. And one week after another, there are new changes, new announcements, new alterations in the traditional ways in which our federal health agencies, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, has talked about the importance of vaccines. This isn't a surprise coming from this new class of public health leaders, given longstanding skepticism, criticism, or worse towards vaccines. But it's all incredibly disruptive to the success of vaccination programs. So, you know, we can delve into some of the twists and turns, but certainly the climate is one of turbulence and confusion as it comes to where we stand with vaccines these days in the U.S.
I mean, the history here is interesting, and you're a historian. Is this anti-vax movement today, the contemporary anti-vax movement, new, or has it been around for 100 years? I mean, what's the history there? And if it's relatively old, like what's changed? What's made it so much more visible and virulent, I guess you could say?
For as long as we've had vaccines, governments have sought to promote their benefits, and individuals and groups have questioned the safety of vaccines, the necessity of vaccines, the value of vaccines. So there's a lot of continuity here through the ages, literally going back to the earliest vaccination campaigns in the 19th century against smallpox. So there's lots of continuities in terms of the criticisms, the idea that there are unknown risks of vaccines or that government should stay out of decisions about whether individuals or parents should use vaccines. And we see a lot of the same kinds of rhetoric throughout the ages, even as the science changes, the disease changes, the political moment changes. But within that sort of stream of continuity, there are some real worrisome transformations that are happening more recently. And the most notable one, we see this in our political moment here, is that traditionally the skepticism, the criticism, the opposition to vaccines came from all segments of the population, folks who preferred a more natural lifestyle, who might be seen as more sort of progressive or left-leaning, people who were concerned about chemicals or toxins at the same time as folks who may have been more sort of a libertarian bent or a politically conservative orientation, so that you'd have sort of a strange bedfellows when it came to questioning vaccines. What we're seeing now, especially since COVID, is a much more partisan flavor to skepticism and concerns around vaccines. It has become much more of an orthodoxy of Republican-leaning voters and elected officials that have really changed the tenor of these conversations and really added a new front in the threats about the success of vaccine efforts. So I think that's the change, even though there's a whole lot of continuity to it as well.
It's interesting. I mean, it does seem like there has been a significant shift in the disinformation in particular. Just thinking here about like Secretary Kennedy's claim that vaccines have never been tested against placebos and things like this. I mean, should we not expect our Secretary of Health to know these facts? Or maybe a better way to put it is like, what is there anything controversial about the studies that were conducted on tens of thousands of people during the pandemic for the mRNA vaccines? Those were tested against placebo. Why does he ignore these facts?
Yeah, you know, there,
you as the psychiatrist in the room.
You know, there are no products in our U.S. healthcare system that are more extensively studied, both before they're used and after they're used, than vaccines. That's just a fact in terms of the size of the trials that are required for vaccines to be licensed, in terms of the number and robustness of the post-licensure safety monitoring systems that are in place for vaccines, precisely because the concerns about risks have been so persistent. The stakes are high. The concerns about the health of children are understandably great. So we have more data to help us understand the safety and value of vaccines than literally any medical product, any pharmaceutical product in our healthcare system. So we've got this data. But what we've seen from the persistent champions of the vaccines cause autism hypothesis that's been debunked for decades, and other critics of vaccine safety like Mr. Kennedy, are persistent questioning of the data, that there's always a question that wasn't quite asked in the right way, or there's always some sort of methodological flaw, or there's always some group that has a conflict of interest that renders the research that they've published not credible, that there's always sort of a shifting of the goalposts in terms of data that doesn't fit the framework that says there must be something wrong with vaccines. And we're seeing that here. We're seeing that here with both questioning of the evidence that's there, as well as a persistent introduction of new theories, new hypotheses that must be the reason that vaccines cause harm. If it's not a particular ingredient or a particular vaccine, it's something about the vaccine schedule. It's something about the way vaccines were tested. I often compare it to that arcade game Whack-A-Mole that the scientific community is always trying to chase the new hypothesis that's being put forward there. And when evidence refutes that, we hear new concerns emerge from some of these critics. So it's an incredibly challenging moment in the best of times, even more so when the individuals who are proffering these theories are now in the highest positions of our federal government's health agencies.
Yeah. I mean, these are unanswerable questions precisely because it's really pseudoscience that's driving them, right? These are non-falsifiable claims, really, at the end of the day.
Can't prove a negative, right? We know that. We can have all the evidence in the world that shows there is no evidence that suggests a link between vaccine hypothesis X and disease Y, and you can have as many robust, large studies. But A, if those studies are not being accepted by the people whose minds are trying to be changed, or if that idea that's saying, well, maybe that scientific evidence doesn't explain this particular case or this particular one, that we find ourselves sort of spinning our wheels again, as we have for so many decades, but as it comes to these vaccine safety allegations.
Before I shift over to some actual clinical questions, I'm just curious about, so you studied how vaccine advisory committees function and what they've done over the course of however long they've been around. I don't know, you'll have to remind me again, but the policies that have been developed by these committees regarding approval and distribution, access, rationing, allocation, perhaps. Are these kinds of committees still up and running, functional? What's happening with that infrastructure?
Yeah, we've had for decades in the U.S. since the 1960s, a group of advisors to the Centers for Disease Control that help us as a country, as a public health community, think through the best way to deploy vaccines that are available, develop those recommended vaccination schedules that are a mainstay of pediatricians' offices that provide that gold standard approach for how we think about vaccines. So that group, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, as it's called, has been seen as a highly credible guide and steward of our national vaccination program. That group still exists. That group has been often criticized by the very voices we're seeing leading the public health agencies, the HHS secretary himself. The groups remain at least active for now, but there's been hiccups in terms of their meetings since the Trump administration took office. One was canceled and rescheduled. Some recommendations they made about relatively lower profile issues have not been acted upon by the CDC director, which is a traditional step in which their recommendations take effect. And most recently, as we're sitting here recording this, we've had these developments regarding COVID vaccine recommendations over the past several days. The kinds of recommendation changes regarding pregnant women and children and the vaccine schedule, the very kinds of recommendations that for decades would have been exactly what this advisory group would have thoughtfully analyzed over many months, deliberated publicly, issued detailed recommendations, and then provided to the public health officials to act upon. And clearly what we've seen over the past several days is that process has been completely tipped on its head. We had an announcement from the HHS secretary himself, a 58-second announcement on social media announcing the outcome. And then the question about how it would be translated into policy was left to the CDC in the days that followed, with no ostensible involvement from these very expert advisors who, while not perfect, have been the most trusted interdisciplinary expert group for decades to help handle what are always challenging questions here. So the process remains unclear in terms of what it looks like going forward, but we certainly have ominous signs from these recent developments in COVID vaccine recommendations.
So that was that recommendation reversed, I believe.
It's a complicated set of developments here in terms of what we mean when we mean something is recommended. And what we're seeing, I think, is a real discomfort on the part of the new administration for government health agencies, the CDC in particular, to say such and such population should get a vaccine. That's classically what we've meant by our vaccine recommendations, that who should get a vaccine, saying here's our best sense of the evidence and here's what we think one ought to do. This is clearly something that I think we're going to see less of going forward, given the outlook and posture of our current class of public health leaders. So yeah, that has changed, that we no longer have that exhortatory language in our vaccination schedule as CDC took their instructions from the HHS secretary. Now, what they did, and it gets into the sort of the weeds and wonky aspects of vaccine recommendations, they allowed to remain on the books a more tempered, what we call permissive statement, an idea of saying, yep, this vaccine's available, and if you want to get it, you know, talk with your doctor about it, which is not really a recommendation, as most of us would think about the idea of what we hear about, but it does provide for some important insurance coverage programs for public and privately insured folks to remain on the books. So some of the headlines said CDC contradicted Secretary Kennedy. I think that probably pushed it a little bit too far. What we're seeing is very much a retreat from the traditional role of the federal government in providing clear guidance in terms of what they think individuals should do to protect themselves or their family. And I think that's the key continuity here between last week's announcement around COVID vaccines.
Well, along the lines of that language that you're highlighting there, you know, as I pull back and I think about, you know, why vaccines? Why are vaccines being picked on? There are all kinds of medical treatments out there that could be a focus in some way, you know, to the extent that perhaps there's even intentional disinformation and, you know, the cynical reasons to think about the utility of intentional disinformation. You know, why vaccines? And so I would imagine that some component of this must be the compulsory language that's often come around vaccination. Outside of, you know, emergency care, you know, most medical care is highly elective and people every day elect not to be treated for any number of conditions. But, you know, whether it's the recent COVID pandemic or childhood vaccination schedules. At times, you know, vaccinations have been at least somewhat more compulsory. And so, you know, do we think that that may play a role in why it's become a lightning rod and politicized?
Absolutely. I think, you know, vaccines are interesting because they're one of relatively few interventions that are distinctly both medical interventions as well as public health interventions. And they bring in all those different perspectives and outlooks that come with each of those domains. A lot of our public health policies that are often contentious, right, whether it's about taxes on cigarettes or motorcycle helmets or seatbelt laws or other kinds of traditional public health campaigns, are not delivered in the context of a doctor-patient relationship where we might think about those issues about risks and benefits and individual consent. And conversely, lots of our medical interventions don't come with those clear public health benefits that vaccination provides as well. If we think about a decision to receive a statin or a cholesterol drug, there might be concerns for one's loved ones if one doesn't comply with that. But the community benefits of vaccines straddle both domains. And I think that's been both a blessing and a curse for how we think about them and talk about them as a society. And the fact that that public health benefit is exactly what has been the foundation of policies, again, for almost 200 years, that would compel some vaccines for some populations, absolutely has been a lightning rod for public attitudes, public resistance to vaccines in the past, and remains so to this day. So I think that's a huge part of the conversation why vaccines are so often contentious or so often seen as a source of opposition or concern. The other one is the fact that, listen, for me, we have a recommended vaccination schedule that for most children, there are a battery of vaccines that are given on the scale of several million doses a year to kids, all for good reason, all with good evidence supporting their evidence for safety and benefits, but also creating lots of opportunities for concerns to emerge of a vaccine being associated with all of the kinds of conditions, developmental or otherwise, that emerge in children in the first few years of life. Just as a matter of statistical likelihood, if something, whether it's autism, another chronic disease or other condition emerges around kids in those first few years of life, as is going to happen, chances are there will have been a vaccine administered to that child within the past few months. That's the nature of our recommended vaccination schedule. And that's opened the door for lots of concerns, the classic correlation and causation concerns that maybe something about that vaccine had something to do with that diagnosis emerging. So I think the confluence of those two considerations, the public health imperatives, as well as the robustness of vaccines and the fact that the concern that maybe that's something that's going on there that just hasn't quite been understood about a vaccine causing a harm in a child, an understandable quest for knowledge that parents would have if, God forbid, something happens to their child, leads vaccines to be so contentious, at least among the voices that we hear most vocally.
I think that's one of the more disturbing aspects here is that the desperation of parents is often exploited by this kind of misinformation, disinformation, lying, whatever you want to call it. This is a period of time when you're very vulnerable as a parent. You're very worried. You want your kid to be healthy, and something goes sideways, and you look for a reason. It's kind of common, kind of a natural impulse to look for something to blame, I guess. So I guess that leads me to my next question, which is how should clinicians navigate this very confusing messaging landscape for their patients when maybe a patient or parent shows up and wants to delay vaccination, or maybe doesn't want to get their kid vaccinated against measles or something? What are some sort of things you've learned over the years, Jason, around communication and ethical kind of responses to people who maybe are just like unaware, misinformed, and being led astray by people who are maybe not providing accurate information?
Yeah, we hear a lot in the vaccine conversations about what we refer to as a spectrum of vaccine hesitancy, that often so much of the attention goes to the most vocal, strident opponents of vaccines, the people who are in the news, who are protesting on state capitals, who are writing books, who are sure that vaccines cause harm, and maybe there's a big cover-up or a conspiracy or some real open and shut case in terms of the most committed opponents of vaccines. And obviously they are large figures in our public conversation around vaccines, but it's always noted that they're a relatively small portion of parents or individuals who may have doubts or questions or concerns about vaccines. And far larger are the kinds of parents, Dom, who you're referring to, whether in some cases because they're trying to understand something that may have happened to their child, or more broadly, their parents, perhaps new parents, they hear all this debate, they hear all these things in the news and headlines and concerns and claims and counterclaims, and they're just trying to do right by their kids. They're trying to help sort through the noise. They're not following this day in and day out. They may have other things in their lives, other issues to think about, and they're just trying to figure out what's the best thing to do to protect their child. And that's where pediatricians and other healthcare providers become so important as sort of trusted messengers to help us as a society and help these parents in particular understand what we know, what the science says, what the best evidence points to amid all this concern. And understandably, for lots of pediatricians in particular, this topic is exhausting and fatiguing in terms of having to sometimes describe, you know, several times a day to families the same discredited allegations that are circulating online or are getting amplified now by, you know, sadly, individuals with great megaphones and great access to our own public health establishment. It can be a real source of frustration for healthcare providers to provide the kind of empathy, care, clear communication to help understand the root of a concerns parents might have when they're thinking about a vaccine or the vaccination schedule, answer any doubts, answer any concerns or questions, and give them the kinds of information that they're looking for. That's the goal. Now, I'll say, there's a lot of debate, ethical debate and otherwise, among pediatricians in particular to say what ultimately, of course, that's the ideal. That's challenging in our healthcare system, clearly, to provide the kind of time for these extended conversations around vaccines. Our healthcare system isn't designed for those kinds of conversations, valuable as they are. But there's been a really interesting ethical debate over the years about what about those parents who really say, okay, that's all well and good, but I really want to skip this vaccine or that vaccines or most vaccines or all vaccines. And the pediatricians, American Academy of Pediatrics in particular, have issued several statements of saying when, if ever, is it okay for a healthcare provider to say, if that's your position, then perhaps I'm not the pediatrician for you or your family. And there's a range of views about, you know, whether that's a good gesture to protect the medical practice, to show the importance of vaccines, to be consistent with the healthcare provider's values, or whether that might cause more risk to the child going forward if they're sort of lost to the mainstream vaccination system by going off and finding alternative providers who one can find online, who will accept any or all approach to vaccines. And that maybe that by continuing a relationship, even if there's a disconnect for a time about agreeing to the recommended vaccination schedule, over time, trust can build, a relationship can build. And in time, that whatever's causing concern among those parents may dissipate. I'm sympathetic to that view, the better late than never approach. But there's a strong difference of opinion among sort of what the best course of actions for both patients and their families is on that response to vaccine hesitancy.
Yeah, I guess if you're in a one room office and you don't want kids showing up or unvaccinated or something. But aside from those kinds of sort of logistical issues, I think I agree with you, Jason. And I think, I mean, just to like mention Paul Offit here, our colleague at CHOP, I mean, I think he went from the one position to the other over the years, if I recall, right, from being kind of prohibitive about not unvaccinated kids to now being more amenable to working with families. Is that typical for a lot of pediatricians and folks?
I think you see a range of views. And again, you know, every set of concerns around vaccine hesitancy looks different. A very, very small number of parents say, I don't want any vaccine altogether. In some cases, there are religious or cultural reasons underpinning that. For most parents who come to their pediatrician's office with concerns around vaccines, it's something about a particular vaccine that they've read about. It's something about a particular timing, a particular dose, particular number of vaccines. It's rarely, I don't want any vaccines to begin with. And I'd argue that, you know, the approaches to those concerns would appropriately sort of be informed by what exactly the concerns are, how they shape the approach desired by the family to vaccines, and the, you know, the conscience of the healthcare provider regarding the potential risks that would come from delaying or declining, you know, some or all vaccines. But I think in general, you know, thinking of it more of as a last resort, if there's just an intractable disconnect between the child's family and the pediatrician that may very likely not just be limited to vaccines, it's right. Better to try and work through that over time for the child's, you know, long-term health.
Are there any religious group? I mean, most religious groups accept vaccines, right? So are there any that do not, maybe Christian Science, or I don't know. I mean, I feel like they do too. Like every religious group seems to be open to vaccination. I just wonder like what these religious objections are, if anything.
Yeah, it's been looked at certainly among the largest sort of, you know, organized faith traditions and religions. There are essentially none that have a clear doctrinal issue that would oppose vaccines. Now, that said, in lots of faith traditions, lots of adherents interpret principles and teachings of their faith tradition differently. So we've seen issues among Mennonite communities and Orthodox Jewish communities where we see measles outbreaks, some Christian Scientists, some Christians, Roman Catholics who have concerns about vaccines that have a remote link to research that was conducted using fetuses that were aborted decades ago. So even if you don't have often a handed down teaching from a central religious leader or central office, you'll find people who will point to their own either religious or faith-based views that sort of put them in conflict with vaccines, at least in their own views. And how to account for that is a large challenge for policy.
Yeah, how do you do that in policy? It's like, oh, well, they have their religious beliefs are incorrect, but we should still, I mean, they're not congruent with the authority, so we should still respect them. They're individual now. I mean, I think that's I guess this is, again, these are edge cases for the most part, but they're interesting questions. Steve, do you have anything you want to?
Yeah, maybe going back for a second to the consideration of pediatricians' responses to refusals. As it was pointed out, these are relatively infrequent, at least at this point. And as you said, Jason, typically more for, you know, one vaccination as part of the schedule, not a blanket refusal for any vaccination. But just considering that, you know, perhaps in some communities and some parts of the country, this might be a growing trend. This could become a more common conversation for pediatricians to have. I suppose, you know, one consideration might be that, to your point before about the considerations of a pediatrician saying, maybe I'm not the pediatrician for you, that might be easier to do if it's one or two patients. But if it was a large population of that practice, this is, after all, their livelihood. And so I imagine there could be some tension there. Additionally, I would think that if we think about examples of, you know, inappropriate antibiotic prescription, you know, where the clinician is pretty sure this is a viral upper respiratory tract infection, but a patient is demanding an antibiotic and they cave to that pressure for any number of reasons, including time. You talked about the energy required to have these long conversations, and that may not fit within a typical visit. The reason why we have commercials that say, talk to your doctor about prescribing me this drug, there are many examples or many cases where there is some pressure on the physician to deliver what the patient is asking for. And so to what extent, you know, do we think, you know, looking forward and thinking about the broader impact of what, you know, is a trend here at this point, that may come into clinician decision-making?
Right. Now, there's two, I think, really important points that you raised there. The first around the sort of talk to your doctor trend. That's essentially what this transformation in the COVID recommendation appears to be now, as CDC has interpreted it. And I suspect, you know, if we're sitting here 6 months, a year from now, we're going to see that for more of our routinely recommended vaccines, sort of that pulling back from here's what the evidence says you should get to here's another vaccine you may want to talk with your healthcare provider about. That adds to the burdens and challenges for healthcare providers to have the evidence at their fingertips to help sort through evidence and values in the same way that it's created challenges with other types of cancer screenings, for example, where the evidence is mixed for different age groups or for different risk profiles and says, all right, about PSA testing or mammograms for different groups, have that conversation. Those are challenging. I empathize with healthcare providers who have to think, especially around prevention, about often large bodies of evidence that don't all point in one direction. And that's where these kinds of evidence-based guidelines, both from our public health officials in the government, from medical professional societies, who also issue vaccine recommendations that I think will be increasingly important, can help provide the kinds of clarity to ensure that there's good evidence-based care happening. So I think that's an important concern we have to think about if the federal government is going to have a more hands-off approach to not even the mandate part of the conversation. That's a state-level policy. But when it comes to the federal government, that idea of saying, here's what the evidence says based on our expert judgment, the sustainability of sort of punting that back to the medical practices and the healthcare providers, I think, is questionable. The other point you made as well about sort of the critical mass of vaccine hesitancy, it's a great one to note, because we know that parents who have concerns or doubts around vaccines and may wish to sort of deviate from the gold standard schedule, those folks are clustered in particular communities, particular areas, that overall the national numbers remain very high for vaccines, higher than most people would think, given all the rancor about vaccines in the news. It's well above 90% for most of our routinely recommended vaccines. But the concern is that the 2 or 3 or 4% of parents who choose not to vaccinate their children are often clustered in the same communities, whether it's because of similar socioeconomic backgrounds or religious faith traditions or the kinds of go to the same kinds of schools that might, you know, have a more alternative approach to healing or wellness or healthcare. And it's always those clusters of unvaccinated kids, those pockets. It's where we see the outbreaks. It's where we see measles in particular, given just how effective it is at exploiting vulnerabilities in our healthcare system. So in our vaccination system, I should say. So thinking that the story looks very differently, I would agree, in those areas where we know we have schools, communities, towns, areas where there's a high number of unvaccinated children. That definitely, I think, changes both the public health imperative for vaccination as well as how individual providers should respond, because the threat looks very differently than it does in sort of a national baseline, thankfully.
I mean, you've got at your disposal like data that show you these hotspots. Will we have those data in 1, 2, 3 years? I mean, what is happening with the surveillance programs at CDC, Jason?
Yeah, lots of data issues, I think, and a lot of my colleagues here at the Yale School of Public Health who are you know, in these worlds, not just for vaccines, but all the other important evidence-based policies and data systems that help us understand the state of America's health and recognize what's working, what's not working, how to prioritize, whether it's infectious or diseases or otherwise, are clearly at risk. I mean, that's not an overstatement to say that you know, many data systems are being either sunsetted, or there's questions about data integrity or questions about sustainability or the staff that manages them. We're seeing this sort of across the board. And we, you know, we could very likely see this certainly with some of that core epidemiological data, the kinds of things that get fed up around infectious disease rates, the immunization rates that get collected through large CDC-sponsored surveys that give us the visibility to say, where are the risks, where are the vulnerabilities, and then how can resources be directed? All that, again, assumes there are resources available to help support those problematic spots, and that itself, of course, is jeopardized by you know, so much of the wholesale cuts both to the federal public health workforce as well as all the support that goes to state and local health departments from the federal government themselves that are being cut back, canceled, and jeopardized here. So the system itself is certainly on the verge of a potential breaking point, given all of the threats basically across the board.
You know, in the spirit of the value of looking for the kernel of truth in anything, mm-hmm. right? I mean, everyone always thinks that they're the good guy, that they're on the right side of an argument. You know, classic example being, which way should the toilet paper roll go? You know, obviously the paper should come over the top. You know, I've heard the arguments that if you have a pet, it can be good for it to come under the bottom so that they can't use their paws and do this. But I feel strongly that unless you have a dog, unless you have the paper coming over the top, that you are diabolical, right? You can't convince me otherwise. So if we apply the toilet paper debate to this argument, beyond, you know, the positions that this reflects the denial of established science or the suppression of necessary research to avert a public health crisis, what's the other side? Is there some kernel of truth we can seek to learn from here to bridge both sides?
Boy, I'd love to see if Dom has a thought on that as well for the conversation. I think, you know, it's an important part here that even, you know, what we're seeing coming in terms of the policies and changes does, you know, reflect, you know, a concern among individuals about trust, about expertise, about trust in science. We're seeing, I think, a swinging the pendulum back in harmful ways to the other extreme. But it's a reminder here that even the concerns that are, you know, being acted upon by our health officials here do reflect the fact that large segments of the population are confused about who to trust, who to believe, what kinds of medical choices to make for themselves or their family. They know that legacy of COVID is real. And to the extent that it helps all of us in public health and healthcare and medicine and medical ethics really think seriously the fact that the questions we ask, how we answer them, how we communicate them, how we build trust in the public, if this incredibly disruptive and harmful shock to our public health, global health, healthcare systems reminds us of the stakes of trying to understand better what we know and how we can help convey that in ways that are clear and understandable to the public going forward. You know, maybe there's the closest I can come to a potential silver lining, but there's obviously lots of harm being done. You know, things will certainly not look this way forever in terms of the risks and threats. But that's, you know, kind of small solace in the meantime, even as we look ahead to saying, what will it look like to rebuild the systems, the infrastructures, the workforces, the programs that have been dismantled even just in these past 5 months with, you know, no end in sight.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, I don't really see any upside here or positive. I totally get what you're saying, Steve, about sort of being biased to your own view. But I feel like this is a sort of almost like mathematics, you know, denying 2 + 2 = 4. There's no way you can really argue with somebody if they think it's 5 right here. So that's just my view.
Yeah, you know, and I'll add one more thought here. One of the challenges for public health and medicine is that it's often fragmented. There's lots of voices that come out, and we see this again, you know, to extend that metaphor to some of the cancer screening recommendations, and you have 7 different groups with 7 different kinds of recommendations about who might, you know, benefit from a particular screening modality, and we see that elsewhere in medicine. Public health and vaccination is certainly true, falls into that as well. And to the extent right now that our usual most credible voice of the federal in the form of the federal government is compromising our vaccination effort and public understanding thereof, that it, to some degree, it's a blessing that there remain lots of other credible voices in the vaccination and public health world, state and local public health departments, at least in many states, although that is also a sort of partisan concern. Medical professional groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics and ACOG, the obstetricians and the family physicians, and lots of groups with deep expertise on these topics, lots of scientists and academics. So the idea that sometimes the fragmented nature of our medical and public health systems that can lead to a cacophony of voices can mean that in a time like this, where, you know, I think we have reasons not to trust what we're hearing from our federal health agencies, there are folks who can individually and collectively try to at least blunt the damage and harm that's being done here. You can't replace a well-functioning FDA or CDC. You can't drown out what comes from that, you know, very powerful platform and bully pulpit. But there are other voices that can try to help recognize that even though the policies may be changing, and that the, you know, certainly the voices of the leaders of our public health agencies are changing, the evidence hasn't changed, the science hasn't changed, whether it's for vaccines or all the other things that we're seeing. And to help communicate that, I think the urgency is critically important in the face of all that we're hearing and seeing from CDC and FDA and NIH and the Department of Health and Human Services itself.
Maybe because I'm an optimist and I want to try to find something that could be somehow a silver lining or a learning from us in going through this experience, but also, you know, for the sake of this discussion and looking at all sides of it, you know, I do wonder if there, going back to my comment earlier about, you know, why are we picking on vaccines? Why are vaccines the particular lightning rod for this debate? If we haven't done ourselves any favor in both the scientific and the medical community in recent past, on the scientific side, of course, there've been many high profile retractions of papers. You know, it's well recognized that, that academia, that science is a competitive field, that there can be pressures to exaggerate findings or falsify findings. It's an opportunity for some skepticism there. On the healthcare delivery side, we have a very imperfect healthcare system. It is full of perverse incentives, many opportunities for people to be hesitant or skeptical about the advice that they're being given. And so, you know, does that create an opportunity? And again, a learning for us here about, you know, opportunities to rebuild trust amongst the lay public in terms of the science we generate and the way we deliver healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say, you know, one of the interesting things, and we often hear this from clinician colleagues, of the idea of challenging, how challenging it may be when a patient comes in with you know, doing their own research. We want, obviously, patients to be empowered, active partners in their medical decision-making. But we know sometimes, right, that Google and searching and Wikipedia stuff can sometimes, you know, lead in directions that aren't, you know, necessarily in the best directions. Vaccine science, I think, has been a reflection of that as well. We've seen in many years, not just the vaccine safety hypotheses being published by papers that are subsequently retracted, the 1998 Andrew Wakefield paper linking the MMR vaccine to autism, published in The Lancet and retracted, is the most prominent example. But we've seen amid the outgrowth of medical journals with scientific sounding names, some of them of questionable scientific quality, some of them predatory in nature, but looking and sounding to lay eyes like credible, reputable websites and reputable sources of public health and medical information as a huge venue for disseminating work that puts forward questionable theories and hypotheses about the safety of vaccines. And there's that sort of that sea, that marketplace sea of medical and scientific information, you know, adds challenges to the debate, because say, oh, here's a published paper saying that this vaccine ingredient has caused, you know, 6,000 deaths based on some questionable methods or questionable editorial review, or whether there's even a journal there to begin with. So thinking again about this question of course, we want transparency and openness, and we want a climate where, you know, even, you know, either contrarian or non, you know, majority views still can be aired and evaluated based on the quality of the data and evidence. The vaccine safety world has fallen prey to lots of dubious, questionable, usually refuted and debunked kinds of papers that legitimize theories and sort of get us back on that treadmill of trying to explain, you know, why we know what we know. Not to say, I should acknowledge, of course, it's worth noting, no medical intervention is free from risk. There are very rare harms, but harms nonetheless that can result from vaccines that are carefully studied and monitored and responded to and often, addressed in changing recommendations. But, you know, and I think we need to do a better job explaining that, of course, you know, while no vaccine or nothing in healthcare is free from all risks, the safety profile of vaccines is well known and sterling and continually assessed. And when things go wrong, as happened with the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine, I think is the most recent prominent example that a rare adverse event was identified in part through the rigorous study. And it said, you know, the policymakers and health officials said, in light of that rare risk, it no longer made sense to go forward using that vaccine when we had other vaccines available that didn't cause it. And that was the end of the J&J vaccine there. So, the idea that there's cover-ups or sanitizing of vaccine safety issues just doesn't follow with the evidence there. The contrary does. But helping explain all that and clarify that is a daunting task in the best of times, let alone in the times like we're encountering right now.
Well, in terms of wrapping up here, Jason, I just want to say, you know, I said this to you long ago, but, you know, you picked a topic that was somewhat prescient. It was very prescient, but way back when you were figuring out your dissertation topic. And I just want to, like, commend you for making your work for having such relevant and incredible work and for, you know, educating not only our listeners, but I know you do a lot of this, all the time in public. You work with Connecticut's legislature, you do all kinds of really important public education work. So thank you for that. And thanks for being on the pod with Steve and I.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Echoing Dom, really appreciate your time and expertise. I really enjoyed this conversation, an important subject, of course. And so really important that we had such a expert and knowledgeable guest to discuss it with us today. So thank you so much. Thank you to our listeners. If they're still hanging in there with us, hope you found today's episode informative and helpful. And please tune in for the next episode of Medical Ethics Unpacked.